This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Klingon Empire has 50 years of life left to it.
To offer Klingons a safe haven within Federation space is suicide.
They're animals.
Jim, they are dying.
You, Captain Kirk, are to be our first olive branch.
Me?
The galaxy stands at a crossroads.
This is the Starship Enterprise. We've been ordered to escort you to your meeting on Earth.
Guess who's coming to dinner?
I have so wanted to meet you, Captain. One warrior to another.
Right. On the verge of peace.
The undiscovered country. The future.
On the brink of war.
We come in peace, and you blatantly defy that.
We haven't fired.
According to our databanks, we have.
I shall blow you out of the stars.
Now, the crew of the Starship Enterprise
will not be the instigators of full-scale war on the eve of universal peace.
They're coming about.
Battle stations.
Fights not to win battles.
Incoming.
Signal our surrender.
Captain?
We surrender.
But to end them forever.
We would consider an attempt to rescue them an act of war.
There will never be a better time.
This is Captain Sulu, USS Excelsior. We stand ready to assist you.
This is fun. You do prefer it this way, as it was meant to be. Warrior to warrior.
Much more of
this. Cry havoc! Kill! And let's slip the dogs of war!
Fire!
Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Is it art imitating life or life imitating art? It's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Welcome, everyone, to another installment of our special series here on Pop Goes the Classics, right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, The Experience. The Star Trek movie franchise. We are on part six, the end of an era. And thank God they did this one, because if they ended with the last one, I don't know what any of us would have done. Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, otherwise known as Star Trek VI. We fucked up five and have to do one more. I am, of course, Scott Griscolo. Joining me, as always, Rob Piontek, a.k.a. Tech. Yeah. Thank God for this one, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me back. Good. It's a pleasure to be talking about this one.
I know. Yeah, definitely. All right. So before we dive in, let's do a quick scoreboard update. You and I have the same one through five, except our numbers are different. You have Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II at 48 points, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock at 42, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home at 39, Star Trek The Motion Picture at 36, and Star Trek V, The Final Frontier at 25. Of course, we remember we'll do the – I'll let you know the categories in a sec. Well, if you should know at this point since this is the sixth episode. I have Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan at 49.5. I have Star Trek III, The Search for Spock at 43. I have Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home at 37.5. I have Star Trek, The Motion Picture at 34.5. And I have Star Trek V, The Final Frontier at 24.5. So overall, we kind of go back and forth in terms of who has higher than the other. And it's usually by a point and a half. Like, for instance, I have Khan a point and a half higher than you. I have Search for Spock a point higher than you. You have Voyage Home a point and a half higher than me. You have Motion Picture a point and a half higher than me. And you actually have Final Frontier a half point higher than me. Sleep on that one. Regretting that half point. So on average, we're about the same. Okay. So as I mentioned, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which came out on December 6th, my mom's birthday, 1991. So it's been 2 years since that debacle that the Shat put together. Yeah. I don't remember. I mean, I know you were young, obviously younger than me. I don't remember if there was scuttle about them doing a sixth one, or if they thought that five sucked so bad that they were just going to end it. Yeah, I don't really remember. But then when I heard that they were that a sixth one was coming out, I was excited. And then when I started reading stuff, and it was evident that this was it for the original cast. I mean, obviously all of them were getting a little cinematically a little long in the tooth. So it was getting to that point now where it was time to give them a nice farewell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Leonard and DeForest and, you know, Nichelle, they were all getting up there. I mean, most of them weren't probably in their, I would assume, mid-50s at that point. And I'm sure they wanted to go out on a better note than that dumpster fire that came out 2 years earlier. So
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So Nicholas, after Leonard does two straight good ones and the Shat does one straight bad one, Nicholas Meyer comes back. Of course, he'd done mostly writing of stuff since directing The Wrath of Khan. So you might as well go back to the best one for your director. But for the first time, no Harve Bennett. He is not, he doesn't write anything, nor does he produce anything for this film. So we say farewell to Harve.
Yeah, it's kind of left unsaid if he shouldered the blame for five and they just kind of said, and you're done.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. There's a lot of back and forth. Let me see what it says here. Oh, here we go. Okay. Okay. With the looming 25th anniversary of the original series in 1991, producer Harve Bennett revisited an idea Ralph Winter had for the Voyage Home. Young versions of Kirk and Spock at the Academy. Hmm. I remember that had come up for the second one, and the fourth one, but I remember for the second one anyway. I lost my place. The prequel was designed to be a way of keeping the characters, if not the actors, in what was called Top Gun in Outer Space. Bennett and the Final Frontier writer David Lockery wrote a script entitled The Academy Years, where McCoy talks about how he met Kirk and Spock while addressing a group of Academy graduates. The script shows Kirk and Spock's upbringing, their meeting McCoy and Scotty at the Academy, and defeating a villain before parting ways, and then they would talk about how they would get back together when they all got on the Enterprise. The script would have established that George Kirk, Jim's dad, was a pilot who went missing, presumed dead, during a warp experiment with Scotty. The script is set before the enlightenment of the Federation. Slavery and racism are common, with Spock being bullied because he is the only Vulcan student, and Nurse Christine Chapel would cameo in the script's climax. Before I go any further, what would your thoughts have been if that was the case?
I mean, it's hard to give a uninformed answer because about 90% of what you just described ended up in J.J. Abrams' 2009 movie.
Pretty much, right?
Yeah, just with some variations. Like, you have George Kirk, you have Kirk and Spock at the Academy together, you have them meeting Bones and Scotty and everything. Scotty was even kind of disgraced as the result of a failed experiment. So, right. Yeah, that's pretty much the movie we got in 2009. Which I loved, answer your question.
I know. Actor James Doohan, of course, Scotty, claim that Paramount chief Frank Mancuso, who for you horror movie fans know that name very well because he was very close to the Friday the 13th franchise, of course, which is a Paramount property, had fired Bennett following negative reaction from the core cast Roddenberry, who was very sick at the time, and fans. Bennett claimed that after he rewrote the script to include Shatner and Nimoy, Paramount still rejected it and decided it was time for him to exit stage left. He said, my term was up. I was offered $1.5 million to do six. And I said, thanks. I don't want to do that. I want to do the Academy. Listen to this here. Walter Koenig, of course, Chekhov, or as Shatner would say in this, the Star Trek V presser, the guy who played Chekhov.
Yeah.
That's nice, Shatner.
So flattering.
Yeah, really. His script outline was codenamed In Flanders Fields. In it, the Romulans join the Federation and go to war with the Klingons. The Enterprise crew except Spock are forced to retire for not meeting fitness tests. When Spock and his new crew are captured by a monstrous worm-like race of aliens, which Koenig described as things that the monsters and aliens evolved from, the old crew must rescue them. In the end, everybody dies except Spock and McCoy.
That sounds pretty wackadoo.
It does sound wackadoo. The Shat would not have allowed Leonard to live last. No way. No way, knowing him. So Mancuso asked Leonard to conceive the new film to serve as a swan song for the original cast. I think that was probably, for the most part, the general tone, that this was it for the original seven. This was it.
Yes.
Again, they were all getting, you know, up there in years and probably couldn't run around and jump and that kind of thing anymore. And, you know, you have to be realistic. The whole thing of all these movies, particularly starting with Khan, was that Jim was getting old. Mm-hmm. The rest of the cast, it wasn't that big a deal, but I think we all alluded to the fact that they were all getting up there, you know.
Yeah, both the actors and the characters.
Exactly. Nimoy, Mark Rosenthal, and Lawrence Connor suggested Kirk meeting Picard. But the Next Gen producers refused to end their show. Let's take that into account. We talked about this during both in the last two episodes, the last two parts. Of course, right now, the franchise is doing great because Next Gen, at this point, 91, what are we looking at? Season 5? What 91 is what? Season 4, right?
Of Next Generation?
Yeah, Season 4, I think, 91, which by then, of course, was firing on all cylinders.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They had totally found their groove.
Yeah.
I think it's season four started in September of 1990.
Okay, so as they were working on this movie, Next Gen was in the middle of season four, so they weren't even close to wrapping.
Yeah,
and they were firing on all cylinders. So the Trek as a franchise was not doing too bad. That might have been another reason why they, in my opinion, I'm curious your thoughts. Probably a reason why they felt okay retiring the original crew in this movie, because the current crew, the Next Gen crew, were doing so well. If this was like, if they had thought about this during like season two when they were still a little shaky, maybe they weren't thinking too much about wanting to retire this crew, because, you know, if you remember, we both do, and all of our fans listening do, Next Gen didn't get out of the gate like Secretariat. It had its growing pains. But by now, by season four, they were on top of the sci-fi world. I don't think we have any issues there. Okay. Nick Meyer, who directed Khan and co-wrote Voyage Home, and was also approached for an idea for the sixth film, he didn't have any. Ralph Winter was brought onto the project as producer shortly after Harv left, and said Paramount's mandate was to produce a film that could honor the 25th anniversary, and most importantly, be cheap. So Leonard goes to Nick Meyer's house and says, "Well, what's going on in the world right now?" "Well, 2 years ago, the wall came down in Germany. Combination of both President Reagan and Gorbachev. Communism ended. The Soviet Union officially was gone, and it was now back to just Russia. Nobody really called it Russia anymore. Why don't we do that in space? Why don't we take Starfleet, which represents the United States, and the race that most Gene pretty much made act like the Russians throughout the entire series and most of the movie franchise, of course, the Klingons, and bury the hatchet. And thus we get our story for the Undiscovered Country. Through completely their own fault, one of Klingon's moons, or one of the Klingon planet's moons, has collapsed, and they're in 50 years they will be extinct. Their planet will be goo. So they approach Starfleet about burying the hatchet and help us, and that's it. The war is over. No more hostilities. We promise. Please help us. Those days are over. Days of Kor. I miss Kor. John Colicos. Right? Kor? Was that his name?
Yep. Yep.
Kor. I'm glad I remember that. I feel good about that. John Colicos. Love him so much. Amazing concept. Fit for the times. So let's dive into that. Let's go to our first category. Plot. So they have a secret meeting. Starfleet. Classified. And all the muckety-mucks decide that they're going to have an envoy, meet with this envoy of Klingons, have a little Geneva convention, and work out, hammer out the beginning details. The muckety-mucks tell Kirk, I think you'd work well with the Klingons, right? Why don't you handle this? And Jim looks at him and goes, the fuck I am, scumbags. And, you know, they have Jim and Spock have a chat. Spock pretty much tells Jim to come to Jesus, and Jim and one of the greatest lines ever. And I always smile because to me it's another good Jim line. I know one of your favorite Jim moments is a couple of movies before during Search for Spock when he doesn't miss a beat when they tell him he'll never be captain again, and he fires off in Star Trek III. But pretty much one of the best Kirk lines is, let them die. Because obviously, Jim has a history. They killed his son. End of story. On top of the fact they've just been the thorn in Starfleet's side for decades. He's like, you know what? Why should we help them? They'll just stab us in the back again. Let them go. Less headaches for us.
And it's funny you bring that up. Or, well, maybe funny's not the right word. But Shatner himself kind of had issue with that line. To the point where he felt it didn't really, you know, Jim Kirk wouldn't say something like that, wouldn't be so cavalier, to the point where he said, let me kind of follow the line delivery with, you know, the gesture that essentially says, I didn't mean that. And he had a discussion with Nick Meyer, and Nick Meyer was like, yeah, sure, fine, do that. And then Nick Meyer didn't put it in the movie.
Right. And I'll be honest with you. Sorry.
There's a very like brief shot of him, kind of like one shot of his hand and that look on his face, but not nearly what Shatner wanted to originally convey. So you still kind of get that he has that sense of I didn't mean that, I shouldn't have sent that said that. But yeah, that's a hell of a line.
And I'll be honest with you, my personal opinion, I think Nick Meyer was right. I think you needed Kirk to convey that he should be pissed off. We shouldn't trust them. Look at years and years and years of fucking with us, and they killed my son. So don't. And I almost feel like and I think one thing I think I liked the Shat's conveyance here is it's almost like Starfleet's fucking with him. Like, really? Of all the fucking guys, you pick me? Really? Come on. So I almost think like Spock's. It's almost like Jim thinks Spock's fucking with him, you know.
And that's where the line that follows that comes from is only Nixon could go to China. That's old proverb.
Yeah, that's great. So they have my other favorite line is Chekhov. Guess who's coming to dinner? I love that line. Then we get everybody meets. We'll get to casting in a minute. And then somehow the Enterprise mysteriously fires on the Klingon envoy ship, kills severely injures, and eventually the ambassador dies, and the Klingons send Kirk, Spock, and Bones to – or Kirk and Bones. Or was it all three of them? No, it was Kirk and Bones. To pretty much a Klingon version of Siberia. You don't think that was by accident. pretty much a space gulag, and then they figure out the whole thing, and in the end, they figure out what happened, and you know, everybody's happy at the end. Your thoughts on this, on the plot? I thought it was a great story. I thought it was fitting for the – I do think it was fitting for the times and the ebbs and flows of emotion really fit the story. And I think Nicholas Meyer did a great job of telling that story from the camera.
Yes, absolutely. My personal elevator pitch when trying to talk this movie up to people is that it's a political murder mystery set against an allegory of the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, how could you go wrong with that? Yeah, you literally start with a nod to Chernobyl, you know, this production facility of the Klingon Empire just explodes and sends them into this downward spiral. It's Chernobyl. And yeah, it's the parallel of the subsequent fall of the Berlin Wall and all that. And it's great. Doing that, tapping into the issues of the day, it goes back to Gene Roddenberry's original plan for what he did on the original series. This was a mm-hmm. guy who was writing morality tales about current issues, you know, racism, war, you know, all that kind of stuff that was rampant in the 60s. You're taking that mentality, you're applying it really for the first time in one of the, I mean, yeah, you could argue Star Trek IV is the, you know, obviously save the whales, the 80s environmentalism, but this one really hits home in terms of what is going on specifically, you know, to take it one for one with Russia and the Klingons and all that, and drawing that, that through line. Yeah, it's, so that's your backdrop. And then, yeah, you set this murder mystery. You have this world leader, quote unquote, assassinated. You know, your heroes are implicated falsely, as we know, or do we? And then it just goes from there. You have, you know, strong characters on both sides as this story plays out. And it's so well done. And the choice to bring Nick Meyer back as a director was, you know, a brilliant move. You know, he more than proved himself with 2 as a director, as well as a co-writer on 4. So to bring him back here in, you know, contributing in both respects to this one, just you nailed it. You really would have had to do something wrong to screw this movie up when you had all that going for it.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. And I think that I think it's echoed in the cast, which will be our next category. So mm-hmm. Because the cast is brilliant. After a lot of holes in the cast of the last movie, we had a ton of excellence in this one. So what do you grade the plot? Story?
This plot gets a 10 from me. It gets a 10. It's just like I said, it harkens back to and appropriately for the 25th anniversary of Star Trek, 1991, it held that spirit of the original series and what Gene wanted to do on television, and they did it on screen.
Yeah, and it was a fitting end to this chapter of Star Trek lore. Not only do we see the end of the original cast, but we see the end of the war between Starfleet and the Klingons. Mm-hmm. Everything from the original era of Trek ends in this movie. So I thought it was a perfect bow tie to the last to these first 25 years. So I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And one could argue that seeing as Next Gen, you know, 4 years prior, being set, you know, 70, 80 years after this, but, you know, being produced and aired 4 years prior, they had not really painted themselves into a corner, but they had established with Worf being on the bridge of the Enterprise that the Klingons and the Federation had resolved their differences at some point. So while they weren't, you know, locked into a date or anything, they kind of took that to say, hey, you know, we could tell that story here.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. And kudos to Nick Meyer, because apparently they were worried, and this is just fucking childish at this point. Paramount would have known that if they gave Leonard the chance to the directing job, you knew that the Shat was not going to be thrilled. And in this instance, in my opinion, is Paramount has every right to say, well, we gave you a chance and that movie sucked. But anyway, we digress on that. I give the plot a 9. only because I wish the Shat was less forgiving than they made him out to be. I feel like the only other movie I gave a 10 to for the plot, actually I've never given, I gave Khan a 10, and I think that that's still the best story of any movie thus far. So I feel like I just fall short from being a perfect plot for me. All right. So 10 for you, 9.5 for me. 9 for me. Casting.
Oh boy.
Wow. Not a lot of issues.
This obviously, movie is a powerhouse of talent in it.
It really is. I mean, it's amazing. Obviously the Shat's back. Obviously Leonard's back. DeForest is back.
Yeah, our main seven are back with one notable difference.
Yes.
And that's Sulu.
Yes, who is not in the crew. He's in the movie, but he's not in the crew because Sulu actually got his own command.
Yeah.
He's the captain of the Excelsior. The Undiscovered Country marked the first canonical mention of Sulu's first name, Hikaru, which was first mentioned in the novel, The Entropy Effect. Kind of cool. Interesting. With Nimoy, the film's executive producer, the 71-year-old Kelly was paid $1 million for the role, assuring a comfortable retirement for the actor.
Good for him.
Kelly and Shatner shot their prison scenes over the course of 6 to 8 nights. The two actors got to know each other better than they ever had. Yeah, that makes sense.
I bet.
Obviously, again, so James Doohan's back as Scotty. Walter Koenig's back as Chekhov. Nichelle is back as Uhura. Listen to this one. Uhura was supposed to give a dramatic speech in Klingon during the film, but midway through production, the speech was scrapped, and a scene where Uhura speaking garbled Klingon while surrounded by books was added for extra humor. Nichols protested the scene, wondering why there were still books in the 23rd century, but accepted the change since it would be the last Star Trek film she'd be in. Being African-American, Nichols was uncomfortable with some of the dialogue's racial undertones. Nichols was originally to speak the line, "Guess who's coming to dinner," as the Klingons arrive on the Enterprise. Nichols refused to say the line, which was given to Koenig's character in the final print. Nichols also refused to say the line, "Yes, but would you like your daughter to marry one," meaning a Klingon, and it was dropped from the film altogether. So they were stealing lines from the movie with Spencer Tracy and Sidney Poitier. Now, of course, they gave the line to Chekhov, and then the other line they ditched altogether. We're going to keep going with the heavyweights, and then I'll mention my one blight on the cast. The next two are heavyweights. Playing a one-eyed Klingon general is one of the most untrek thinking actors you would ever think of to be in a movie, and that is Connecticut native, Connecticut resident, I should say native, he's not from Connecticut. Connecticut resident and all-time great actor, Christopher Plummer. Damn, was he good. I mean, not that we were going to ever doubt that, but damn, was he good. Another screen, as you say, sir, and I'm stealing one of your lines, another scenery chewer.
Absolutely.
You know,
he's your picking thoughts it on out him. Of his teeth in this movie.
Absolutely. Your thoughts on him in this role.
Oh, my God. It's just... Well, the first thing that's cool about Christopher Plummer in this movie is obviously his look.
Yes. You know,
he's got an eye patch literally bolted to his face. He's a bald Klingon with the exception of this tiny little like rat tail in the back of his head. Mm-hmm. Has a very reduced kind of cranial ridge, but it works all so well. And as we both know, he kind of requested that. He's like, I don't want a big, you know, wig and forehead and everything. So they made him kind of this, you know, streamlined Klingon.
Right.
And of course, they, just to balance it all out, they gave him this giant like sash to give himself some girth. But I mean, holy hell, you know, Captain Von Trapp is in a Star Trek movie, you know, and it's a little cliched now to like, you know, the Shakespeare spouting villain, you know, trope in any kind of either sci-fi or whatever. But this is the guy who really sells it for you. You know, from the moment he appears, when, you know, you meet him, right until the moment when he meets, spoiler alert, when he meets his end, you know, the guy is just quoting the Bard any chance he gets. But aside from that, you know, you've got this kind of charismatic whimsy when they're aboard the Enterprise and they're having the state dinner and all that. Then you've got this blistering intensity in the courtroom scene. You know, he starts off, you know, as just kind of like this blustery lawyer type, but then when things really peak in this courtroom sequence, he's screaming at Kirk, you know, don't wait for the translation, answer me now, which is, you know, more or less a nod to the Nuremberg trials.
Right. Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah. So beginning to end, you know, you've hired someone who absolutely knows how to play a villain, absolutely loved to play a villain. His own words, you know, you look at any interview from Christopher Plummer on the Star Trek VI special features, and he just relishes this opportunity to play this character. So it's one thing to have a guy who's incredibly talented. It's an entirely second level to have him utterly committed and having a blast in this role. So, yeah, absolute props to Christopher Plummer.
Mm, he was fantastic. Another scenery chewer is put in a much better role than he was in the fifth one, and that is, of course, the iconic David Warner, who plays Gorkon, the Chancellor of the Klingon High Council, who's the face of the peace treaty, who, of course, gets killed, and then which kind of puts the movie's plot in motion. We saw him in the fifth one. Wasted, could have had a lamp play that role and I think it would have been fine. Nick Meyer knew David Warner from one of my favorite movies that David Warner was ever in, and that was Time After Time, the tremendous 1979 sci-fi time travel movie where I think he plays H.G. Wells in that.
He plays Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper in that.
Future Star Trek villain Malcolm McDowell plays H.G. Wells.
Thank you. I knew I was going to do that. Yes. So, great movie, by the way. Check it out, Time After Time. He wanted to look like Abraham Lincoln because he wanted to be like the vision of the peacemaker. And so he had that crazy beard, which is pretty cool. He was only in the movie for what? 10 minutes? But... ugh. He did more in 10 minutes than he did in the fucking hour plus that he was in the fifth one or whatever.
Yeah, because they let David Warner's presence just be in this movie, you know, and it's great because when you introduce him, he's this, you know, he's a Klingon on the view screen, which 9 times out of 10 is a very ominous presence. And it plays out that way. You know, he's very, you know, stone faced and, you know, oh, you know, it's nice to meet you, or, you know, we are here, essentially. And then Kirk, you know, uncharacteristically invites him to dinner and all that. And then once he's aboard, you get the very dramatic, you know, beam aboard scene with all the Klingons and the snare drums from the music. And everybody's just kind of standing still, stone faced. You know, it looks like a fight could break out at any second. As soon as he opens, even though we heard from him earlier, as soon as he opens his mouth in this new setting, you understand that this is a completely different type of Klingon. This is a guy, while in charge, while the chief Klingon, this is a guy who David Warner's voice kind of lends this gentleness to the character just because of the way he sounds, the way he speaks. And you realize like, oh, this guy's not messing around. You know, he's here to do this. He's here to broker peace. And oh yeah, David Warner's so great.
he really is. He's amazing. Some other quick notes. Rosanna DeSoto's in it. Seen her in plenty of stuff. She's Azabur, Chancellor Gorkon's daughter. Iman is in this. Yes, Mrs. Bowie is in this. Iman plays Martia, a shape-shifting alien on the prison planet Rurapenthi, a.k.a. the Gulag. When the character was developed, they had in mind a space pirate described as, quote, the dark side of Han Solo. Okay.
That could have been cool. If it was still her, it could have been cool.
Yeah, it would have been very cool. Iman was not the first choice. Denny Martin Flynn, who co-wrote the screenplay. You know what we had originally? I don't know if it was mentioned in the... I know you just watched the Disc 2 features. I watched them a few weeks ago. You know who they originally had in the role that they were thinking about? Sigourney Weaver.
Oh.
That might have fit.
That could have worked. That absolutely could have worked.
Because, you know, everyone knows her as Ripley, but she had just played an amazing witch in Working Girl. She was a great bad guy in that. I mean, obviously it's a rom-com, but she was a villain in a rom-com. So I think it might have fit. But instead they got Iman, who did a great job. Brock Peters is back as Admiral Cartwright.
Yes, he is.
And
yeah, we've got like this trio of returning actors slash characters from Star Trek IV. You've got Brock Peters returning as Admiral Cartwright, Mark Leonard returning as Sarek, and John Shuck returning as the Klingon ambassador.
Yes.
All of whom, fantastic performances. And Brock Peters especially, because going back to what you were saying about Nichelle Nichols, how there was all this, let's call it questionable dialogue.
Yeah.
The references to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and Nichelle's, discomfort with that. Brock Peters, in the big scene at the beginning with the Starfleet brass, he levels this incredibly harsh speech at the room, just saying, Klingons would become the alien trash of the galaxy. It's, we should bring them to their knees. Then we'll be in a better position to dictate terms. I mean, holy hell. So, and rightfully so, this actor who, is literally a veteran of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, pretty
the
much.
Man on trial in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yep.
They said that while he was committed to delivering this speech, he was having such difficulty with it that he couldn't even do it in one take.
Nope.
So if you watch the scene, you'll hear the speech. You'll see him giving the speech, and there will be, cuts away from him, and showing reaction shots while you continue to hear the speech, which is from, different takes cut together. But yeah, even he was having trouble with this very, very difficult dialogue.
Yeah. And of course we would later see him in a much more soft and fun role as Joe Sisko, our beloved captain's dad on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yes, indeed.
Another guy who would end up being a DS9 regular. I'm going to let you give him for years, even when he was on Benson, I could never say his last name. I'm going to let you say it.
Okay. Well, it's funny because when you talk about DS9 in this movie, there's actually two people you could talk about, but I know exactly who you mean. You're talking about René Auberjonois.
Yes.
Who is, 2 years out from playing Constable Odo on Deep Space Nine. But here we have it. And what's funny about this role is, so I didn't see Star Trek VI in the theater. I've only known it on home video and such. So, the scenes with his character, Colonel West, were not in the theatrical cut of this movie.
No.
But I never knew that because I never saw the theatrical cut. So the whole scene where he comes into the president's office and, gives his, spiel about, oh, this is our rescue plan for getting Kirk and McCoy. And then the follow-up scene with him at the end of the movie, again, spoiler alert, where he is revealed to be the masked, not-so-Klingon assassin.
Correct.
Yeah, so there was a cut of this movie where his role was completely omitted, but I've never seen that version. But what is fun to note, even though he is under no prosthetics, it's just René Auberjonois with a mustache, he is doing the Odo voice in this movie. If you close your eyes and if you're familiar with DS9, you will think it's Odo. He's playing Odo in this movie. But of course, in addition to him, we have another, Trek alum in general, but yeah, he would be his co-star on Deep Space Nine. Michael Dorn is in this movie.
Yes, he is.
Playing his own character's grandfather.
So great.
So, like we said, Next Gen is you know, at least four seasons in, you know, by the time this movie comes out, season five is on the air.
Yeah.
And again, we go back to that courtroom scene and, you know, again, close your eyes. You're like, that's Worf. That's Michael Dorn's voice. And yeah, he is referred to as Colonel Worf. So, but it's, while it's not expressly said on the screen, it's, he is Worf's grandfather, father of Moog.
Yes,
of course. But Moog, yeah, it's really cool to, you know, see that kind of next gen, you know, I don't know, they just kind of threw him the bone and said, like, we're going to have you in this movie to try to, you know, connect our eras that are, you know, with the new one taking shape.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know, that one's just really cool.
I agree. And then, in my opinion, the one casting blight.
Don't say Kurtwood Smith.
Kurtwood Smith is great at everything, as I quote him, dumbass.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's just address that real quick. We've got a couple other, you know, multi-part Trek veterans in this movie. We've got Kurtwood Smith as the Federation president, who would later appear on Deep Space Nine in the episode Things Past, and then again on Voyager in Year of Hell. So he's no, or would become no stranger to Trek. We've got William Morgan Shepherd as the Ruripente warden.
Yep.
And he's all over. He's on Next Gen. He's in Trek 09. You know, he's another one who just made multiple appearances throughout the franchise. And then, of course, on the Bridge of the Excelsior, we see Grace Lee Whitney as once again reprising her role as Janice Rand.
Yes.
After briefly appearing in Star Trek 4 and 3 and 1.
Yes.
Following her brief tenure as Yeoman Rand on TOS. So, yeah, we're pulling out all the stops. You know, I don't know if it was just for the 25th anniversary or if they just said, all these people are great. Let's get them in the movie.
Yep, absolutely. And I love, God rest her soul, I love Grace Lee Whitney. Awesome.
But you had a point you were going to make.
Yes, the blight. And that is Miss Sex in the City herself. Kim Cattrall as Valeris. I did not like her in this movie. She just doesn't fit. They were apparently going to do Savick again, but they weren't bringing back Robin Curtis. And I'm glad, because after what Valeris's character does, I didn't want Savick to do that, and I didn't want Robin Curtis to, because we all love Robin Curtis.
And neither did they.
And neither did they. Roddenberry objected to making a character loved by fans into a villain. So they made a new... I just didn't like her in it. I just think she didn't have that... I'll give... And I didn't really needle it too bad in that episode, but... I gave Kirstie Alley the benefit of the doubt, because she was very young. She was very early in her career. So she was, you know, I won't. And I didn't think she was terrible, but I'm glad they replaced her, because I thought Robin Curtis was better. At this point, you know, Kim Cattrall is no stranger. She's been in a ton of movies. She's been in, you know, Mannequin. At this point. Yeah. I just don't think she fit this role. Then she did something just totally, speaking of trash of the galaxy, she supposedly did a photo shoot on an empty bridge of the Enterprise after a day's filming when everyone was gone, and had pictures taken of her wearing just the ears.
Yep.
And as hot and sexy as some may think that is, and, you know, Kim Cattrall's not ugly, Leonard flipped his shit, and apparently... had all the pictures ripped up, and I'm sure if you try to Google it, you'll probably not find it. And that's just trash for me. That's just trash. So that story always left a bad taste in my mouth about her. And I just didn't like her in this role. I didn't. I think they could have found somebody better. You know? You know what would have been good in that role? Now that I'm thinking about it, because I think she'd have been a good bad guy, even now that she wasn't on Next Gen anymore. Denise Crosby.
Yeah, that
should have been a good bad like heel Vulcan.
And that's kind of, well, to be fair, that's kind of what we got on Next Gen. We got with the Sela, her, you know, Tasha's illegitimate half human, half Romulan daughter.
Yeah, I know. So many words. Yeah, that's what I thought. That was my thinking.
Yeah, you kind of got your wish.
I know, I did. Just not in the right, just in a different setting. So I'm going to give
this,
the cast.
After this, you're going to watch Unification Part
1. I am going to watch Unification, yes. Because I have it on Blu-ray. Looks great. I'm going to give the cast a 9. I'm taking a full point off for Kim Cattrall. The rest of the cast is epic for me. Not just the original 7, but the Plummer, Warner, Iman combo. And then, of course, Brock Peters, and then, you know, multiple actors who would eventually come back in one of yours and my favorite Trek shows ever. So I'm giving the cast a 9. You?
I get your take on Kim Cattrall. She never really bothered me. I thought she was a decent Vulcan. She kind of had that cold delivery and everything. But in terms of my score, I'm going to give the cast a 9.5, and my 0.5 reduction is simply for the fact that they did to George Takei in this movie what they did to Nichelle Nichols in Star Trek III, where you took one of the main cast and you pretty much omitted them from the majority of the movie, inexplicably. Now, I it's great that Sulu got his ship, got his command. He made captain. He's not just sitting at the console saying warp factor 5, captain, anymore. But it would have been great to see, especially for this being their, you know, the original crew's final, you know, voyage, as they say. And it's evident at the end of the movie because Kirk delivers his, you know, his order to the helm, and they do that cool pullback, you know, yearbook shot, for lack of a better description, and Sulu's not there. Everybody's there. Scotty's on the bridge, McCoy's on the bridge, and the helm seat is noticeably absent. So it's just a shame that for the final group movie, the group was incomplete. So that's where I have to take a little bit of points off.
I agree with you on that. That'll be my other half point. I'll take a half point for Kim Cattrall and a half point for that. So, all right, villains. Let's go quick on this one because we kind of went through with them already. the specter of villains was cool, but actual villains, I mean, Renee is cut out of the movie and he's one of the biggest villains of them all. So I don't know how high I could grade the bad guys. What do you think?
I mean, if you're pinning the title of villain on obviously anyone, it's going to be General Chang. It's going to be Christopher Plummer.
Right.
But yes, there are, as you learn, as the movie goes on, there are co-conspirators peppered throughout this movie. One of which, again, spoiler alert, I hope at this point you've seen this movie and I don't have to keep saying that. One of them turns out to be Brock Peters, Admiral Cartwright, which is kind of a wow, but at the same time you're like, oh, you know, he had that attitude about it. The kind of WTF conspirator is the Romulan ambassador who is in one scene at the beginning. Well, up until the point where you realize he's involved, he's in one scene in the president's office and he has, I think, two lines, you know, to the point where this is a weird thing to kind of dovetail off of this. When Spock has to do his mind meld with Valeris to find out who the conspirators are, the DVD version of this movie, the collector's DVD, while not like a director's cut or anything, has one I've always thought odd addition or change, and it's when Spock is doing the mind meld and Valeris getting the names, when they say the names of the conspirators, they flash the face of the person on screen. It's very jarring. It wasn't there in any previous version, theatrical or home video, up until the DVD. And even to the point where in the original cut, when, you know, they say Admiral Cartwright, they say General Chang, and then they say Romulan Ambassador Nonklus. And in this version, they just say Romulan Ambassador, and then they flash his face. So even his name gets omitted from this scene in the movie.
Right.
As much as to say, the audience probably won't know who that is. you know, because he was literally in one scene at 40 minutes ago with one line of dialogue. So it's a little jarring. But if you're looking at the, you know, the cast of villains, and of course, Valeris turns out to be the fifth conspirator after the three of them and Renee's Colonel West. As a whole, if you're looking at these five, they're not much to write home about. Christopher Plummer shoulders all of the, you know, the true title of villain in this movie, even though he is painted as a co-conspirator. So, but I see what you're saying. Like, how do you rank villain in term if you're looking at a group? Well, if we're gonna do that, I was prepared to give Christopher Plummer a 10.
I know,
but if we're gonna do that, yeah, I'll knock it down to a 7, because you know, while he, like I said, while he is carrying the brunt of it, you've got a few forgettable wet blankets.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to knock it down a little bit less. I'm going to give it a 6.5 because I feel like and considering most of the movie, you don't even know who the villains are because the deed is done early in the movie and the exposure is done at the end. And in the middle, you have the Enterprise half of the plot, them going through the ship, trying to figure out what the frick's going on. And then you've got, you know, Jim and Bones in the gulag. So,
yeah.
You don't even think about the villains, and I think that kind of takes away from it because you don't go back to them because you're trying to figure it out. So, okay. So you gave it a 7 and 6.5 for me. Okay. Production value, effects, filming, sets. I mean, the gulag is cool and the whole trudging through the snow kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I mean, really, there's nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, the Klingon courtroom thing is kind of cool. I don't know. What is there to write home about? Like, that's amazing in terms of a visual or a style or a, you know, I don't know.
The first thing of note, at least for me, is the fact that all the sets, all the familiar sets, which at this point is really just the Enterprise Bridge, immediately looks 10 times better than it did in the previous movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Star Trek V, the bridge just has this kind of beige overtone. It's lit very poorly. It looks like there's just a bunch of, horizontal fluorescent bulbs just out of camera shot in the ceiling. Yeah. This one, you've got some really solid lighting. The bridge has more of like a dark metallic look to it. There's more of a sheen on the screens. You know, you've got this blue and green color scheme going on a lot of the displays. At the same time, though, you have a really clever reuse of standing sets from Next Gen, notably the corridors. You know, anytime they're walking down the halls, you see that telltale black glass computer terminal. But they altered it to give it kind of this claustrophobic submarine look by putting these archways, you know, every like 10 feet in the hallway to give it this cramped look. The engine room is the Enterprise D's engine room from Next Gen, where Scotty spends the last act of the movie screaming at the status of the shields.
Yes.
The president's office is a very clever redress of 10 forward from Next Gen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kirk and Spock's quarters, that's Data's set, set of Data's quarters from Next Gen. So, you know, Herman Zimmerman, who was the production designer on both this movie and that TV series, really kind of stretched the budget in that regard. Even, you know, the dining room, the Enterprise dining room is very clearly the Enterprise D observation lounge. And when they blow up that wall during the final fight, that's the reason why, if you watch Next Gen, for the first 3-4 seasons, there are models of the previous Enterprise, kind of these reliefs on the wall. And then after this movie comes out, they're gone because they blew that wall out and damaged the set. So, yeah. So you've got some, you know, solid reuse of existing sets. I give mad props to the courtroom scene. It's just got this sinister, you know, imposing look to it. You know, you've got that center witness stand in the center with the spotlight on it. You've just got these rows and rows of angry Klingons with pikes, you know, chanting at Kirk and McCoy. And then again, Herman Zimmerman, he kind of lined the wall with these side-facing pyramids, which gives it the look of like an inverse, like studded dog collar to make it even more imposing. So I for one, give the set work, you know, a really solid grade. Even the big thing at the end, the Camp Kittimer, where the conference takes place, both that and the opening scene with the Starfleet briefing, they were both filmed in churches, I think.
Oh, wow.
Very cleverly redressed. So, yeah. And then, of course, yeah, you got your Ruripente, which is pretty much just caves, either real or etched fiberglass. So in all honesty, if we're looking at the whole thing, you know, even, you know, the ship to ship stuff, you know, again, a vast improvement over what we got in the last movie. You know, the models look great. They're properly lit. You know, the even, you know, one of the cooler effects in the movie is when that cloaked bird of prey fires and all you get is the torpedo launching and this kind of quick glimpse of the kind of the shape of the front of the bird of prey while it's invisible. That was always a cool effect. But, you know, they beat the hell out of the Enterprise in this movie. They blow holes in the hull. And I think, I mean, if I'm not too much mistaken, there's a actual use of a CG Enterprise in this movie during that fight. And to be fair, for 1991, it blends pretty seamlessly with the model work. So, you know, there's all that. And then, of course, there's the scene during the actual assassination, where they did mm-hmm. some pretty clever stuff. You know, it's a zero-G environment, which is next to incredibly rare for Star Trek. You see it, you know, next to nowhere else. So you've got guys on wires, you know, pretty convincingly. You know, it's, you know, zero-G is zero-G. But, of course, then you add the CG blood, the pink Klingon blood to kind of give it that, that alien aspect.
Floating.
The one cool effect in that scene is the two Klingon guards that get shot, and in order to make it seem like they're being shot back through zero G, they're actually shot at a 90-degree angle facing upwards, so they just kind of yanked them up instead of back on the rigs. So that worked really well. It was all very effective, you know, good practical use. And then hell, you've got actual legit CG morphing technology in this movie, which again, 1991, that was next to unheard of.
I know.
You know, the big thing with that technology was Michael Jackson's Black or White video.
Yes. Yeah.
That was the breakouts, for that particular special effect. So, you know, you've even got that in this movie. I give the production value, a 9.5. And I take the half point off for two very stupid reasons. One, I hate fake snow. I hate fake snow in movies and television. So, of course, they're in, you know, this snow planet. And while there's a good shot, a chunk of photography that was shot on an actual glacier, I believe in Alaska, anytime, you know, particularly in the fight between Kirk and Kirk, it's just clearly just little strings of white shit on their faces and their clothes. And the other thing, and this is as nitpicky as I'm gonna get, I'm gonna put my nerd glasses on right now and push them up with my index finger. To go off of your dislike of Kim Cattrall, here's my dislike of Kim Cattrall's costume. Because
we talked about this. Yep.
Yeah, this is super Star Trek nitpick.
Oh god,
Lieutenant Valeris's uniform doesn't make any sense.
No,
it doesn't. She's wearing the standard red uniform jacket with a white, or is it gray shoulder strap and gray cuff band, which is where the rank goes. So gray denoting her department. However, the collar of her shirt is red, which is trainee color, which is what Savick wears in Star Trek II. So if you look at any other person wearing a Starfleet uniform, the collar and the rank straps match, depending on your department. White, green, gold, gray, whatever. So first of all, you've got a big faux pas there. Second of all, her rank insignia on her shoulder does not exist. She's addressed as lieutenant in this movie. The lieutenant rank is two separate pieces. They kind of look like triangles. One, the one on top inverted, and the symmetrically another one below it. She has a commander's rank insignia which is kind of this double M top to bottom with two bars in the middle, only it only has one bar. That rank doesn't exist. That rank symbol doesn't exist.
That's
so somebody
bizarre.
In the prop department screwed up royally on a main character's appearance. So, yeah, for a very stupid, nitpicky reason, I'm going to give the overall production value of this movie a 9.5.
Yeah, I gave it a 9. It's pretty solid for the most part, as you've been saying. But yeah, I always thought that too. I'm like, it looks like she borrowed pieces of her uniform from the last few movies and just kind of slapped it all together.
Exactly. She's very pieced together. Yeah, poorly.
I don't get where they just invent a fucking logo or an insignia.
Yeah.
Emblem. That's just bizarre.
If you look at like Uhura and Chekhov, you'll see the actual commander's rank with the two bars, and hers just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. So 9.5 for you, 9 for me. Mm-hmm. Finally, the music. I understand, liking... This is where I have a problem in terms of, a family. Like, I've always considered when you go to the Star Wars franchise, it is almost like the Bond franchise where it's a family. And I wish I could think that about Trek, and I never can. For instance, and the biggest thing of all, every Star Wars movie ever made, I cannot ever think in my mind ever of anybody else other than John Williams doing the music for it. Ever. Ever. No excuse. No debate. Shut your mouth. Not you. I'm saying that. Of course. Symbolically, of course, because you agree with me. Why, for every movie, they just don't ask Jerry first? I don't understand why they fuck around with weird... I just don't understand. They come up with these different kinds of... You know, according to what I have here, Nick Meyer's original plan for the score was to adapt Gustav Holst's orchestral suite, The Planets. The plan proved unfeasibly expensive, so he began listening to demos submitted by composers. Just ask fucking Jerry! I don't get it. Am I wrong on this? Am I making any sense? Am I making no sense? Why don't you just ask Jerry first?
I don't get it. Obviously, all of us would love to hear, Goldsmith score every Star Trek movie.
Ever.
I mean, but to be fair, up until this point, of the five that have come out, he's only done two of them.
That's my point. Well, I've always had a problem with that. I never got that either, why they didn't just ask him every year instead of he takes... And you know what sucks? The three he doesn't score are the three best of the first five. He scores none of the trilogy. I don't get it.
Yeah, it could be argued that of his first... Yeah, his first pair, they're the weakest of the first five.
The weakest movies.
Yeah.
I mean, the music might be one of the few highlights of the first one.
Absolutely. And we said just as much pretty much about both movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Episodes.
So instead, we end up with a very young, I don't say inexperienced, but a young composer named Cliff Edelman. Eidelman. I don't think the music's... Now, having said that, I don't think the music's awful. I don't know. That's something that always bugged me, is the first thing they should think of every time they think about the music for a movie is call Jerry. I just don't get it. Why do you not... You know what I mean? But your thoughts on Cliff Eidelman.
Well, I mean, at first glance, you look this guy, you hear the name, you go, who? This is the guy who scored, Delirious, the John Candy comedy.
Yes.
I think he really pulls it out in this movie. The first thing to say, obviously, about this score is it's so different. It's so different from anything we've heard before. The closest thing is Jerry's score to the first movie, where you just get this kind of meandering, ominous, the music that plays when they're going through the cloud, just like, da, 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 that kind of stuff. This movie starts with an overture, essentially. The opening credits has this really, and the word I have used literally for years is ominous.
Yeah.
It's an ominous theme. You know, the Paramount logo comes up, and before you even see the title of this movie, just when it says, you know, Paramount Pictures presents, you hear, it's this,
yeah,
like, yep. Oh, like something is creeping in the shadows, you know, about to jump out and knife you. And it carries throughout the whole movie, because there is this underlying sinister sense that something is amiss. There's, you know, a bad element among us, you know, again, creeping in the shadows. You've got these conspirators out there who want to undo what our heroes are trying to, you know, have happen. In addition to that, you get this really heroic theme, kind of, you know, very light, you know, that doesn't really get to blast itself until the end credits. You get hints of it throughout the movie when cool stuff happens, particularly at the end of the movie, and then, you know, random flourishes throughout. That kind of sounds a bit like James Horner's stuff from 2, you know, which of course didn't sound like anything before it, because it didn't adapt anything from Jerry or, you know, from the first film. The other cool thing he does is this is the first Star Trek score to really use vocals in a very prominent way. There's some solid, you know, vocal use, chanting particularly. In the opening track, you've got this, you know, this vocal element, but the chanting comes in when Kirk and McCoy are brought to Rurapente. And I didn't know this because it's so subtle in the actual score. But if you know to listen to it, you can hear it. He talks about it on the DVD that when they are in the snow approaching the entrance to the gulag, you hear this disembodied choir chanting "to be or not to be" in Klingon.
Yes.
Which is, you know, set up earlier in the movie, because that's what Christopher Plummer says at the dinner. He quotes it in Klingon and all that. So that's just it's a bizarre choice. But, you know, it's cool because, you know, the two characters are on the surface. It's not, you know, like what's the Hamlet, you know, connection here? There isn't any, but it's just this ominous, you know, to be or not to be, you know, are they going to die? You know, they're being sent to prison. And then the last bit is the final battle, you know, as the Enterprise is approaching Khitomer, and, you know, they realize that Chang is there in his bird of prey. They can't see him. He's just kind of stalking them, and he's ready to just annihilate them. It's just this slow build. Again, this ominous tone that, and it just kind of builds with the action, you know, because the Enterprise is getting its butt kicked. Excelsior shows up, and then finally they come up with a plan, you know, how are we going to seek this thing out? And then they nail it with that. Side note, I didn't get to mention this earlier, but just like how I talked, speaking of the final battle, just like how I talked about my favorite Kirk moment is in Star Trek III, this movie has my favorite McCoy moment.
I agree. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep. It's at the end when they realize, oh, we have this equipment, you know, it can, you know, find the, you know, exhaust, or, you know, the engine exhaust or expulsions of this invisible ship. We can use it to find them. And Spock turns to McCoy and says, "Doctor, Would you care to assist me in performing surgery on a torpedo?" And after 25 years of back and forth, McCoy looks at Spock, smiles, and says, "Fascinating." Just the role reversal for that one brief moment is priceless. I absolutely love it. But yeah, go back to the music. It's the final battle music is just this cool build, and, you know, scores the action really well. So that being said, yeah, he's not Jerry Goldsmith. He's not James Horner. He's not even Leonard Rosenman. But I've always really liked Cliff Eidelman's music to this movie, because while it is so different, it fits. It fits the tone. Like I said, just this ominous, unseen specter, a phantom menace, if you will.
I've never heard of that, speaking of John.
Again, it's different. It's not what we've come to expect, but I give it an 8.
Okay, I'll give it an 8 as well. I say this, you know, where's Jerry? But Cliff did a good job, and I did like the chanting at the end. I thought that was pretty good, and I like ominous, particularly in the opening credits of Trek movies. I love the when they play that kind of ominous. Although Jerry's you know, Jerry's theme is pretty great. And of course, you'll hear it at the end of the show, as you've heard the end of every episode thus far. Because how do I not put it? Duh. Man. A Star Wars movie without John Williams. I can't even think about it. I don't know why I even said it out loud. What a waste of oxygen. Well, I mean, all right.
Technically, we did get two of them. He didn't score Solo or Rogue One.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of true, I guess. Yeah. I know. But
you're talking, you know, Star Wars numbered episodes, so.
Yeah, when you're talking about
the episodes. That's how you qualify it.
Yeah, 1 through 9, yeah. The anthologies you can get away with because you didn't have the fanfare in the beginning. Mm. All right. 10, 9.5, 7, 9.5, 8. So, quick math is... 19.5 and 7 is 26.5. 26.5 and 9.5 is 35.5. 35. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Let me do that again. We have to add those together. So 9.5 and 9.5 is 19. 19 and 10 is 29. 29 and 7 is 36. 36 and 8, 44 for you, sir. A 44 for Star Trek VI. So that for you now puts it in second place. It's your number two so far with only Khan ahead of it. Pretty epic, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You have that at 44. You have Khan at 48. And you have Search for Spock at 42. I have 9, 9, 6.5, 9, and 8. So that's 27. 27 and 8 is 35. 35. I have 40.5, so I guess I like this slightly less. I still have it fourth. Let's see. No, I have it third as well. So I have it third. You have it second so far. So I have it in third behind 2 and 3, and you have it in second with only Wrath of Khan behind it. Not bad. There's our final grades. So before we set sail, like the Enterprise did at the end, love the, by the way, speaking of the end, love the line at the end where Kirk steals the line from Peter Pan, where they ask him where to go. Kirk orders a course set for second star to the right and straight on till morning. What a great line. Kirk records in his log that although this mission is the final cruise of Enterprise under his command, others will continue to boldly go where no one has gone before. So, and then in the end, we get the signatures before the credits. Everybody, all the main seven sign. You're sad, but you're not sad. I mean, not sad. Like, you're not, like, not sad, like, oh, I'm glad they're gone. But you're, like, content. This was a good way for them to go out. It did very well, money-wise. On a budget of $27 million, it made $96.9 million, so not bad. Made money. Did these movies overall? Well, first of all, your final take on this one. So a two-parter for you, sir. Your overall take on this one, and did these six movies do this crew justice?
Well, I love Star Trek VI. It's my second favorite Star Trek movie. And I'm pretty sure I spelled out the majority of the reasons why earlier. In terms of the six as a series, I think they were successful in doing what the movie studio wanted, and, you know, Paramount in general, was to kind of reinvigorate Star Trek for, you know, a new audience. It took us from 1970. Eight all the way through 1991 with just six movies, the majority of which are, you know, solid, all of them financially successful in terms of their, you know, what they cost versus what they made. And it was cool to see these movies progress, and therefore, well, the big thing it did was they showed that there was still a audience for new Star Trek. You know, the syndicated episodes of the original series showed that there was definitely a fan base for years and years and years. The animated series, kind of helped bolster that a little bit in the 70s. But it was the movie that really reinvigorated everything to the point where, you know, you get to the mid 80s and they go, we think we can do this on TV again. And you get Next Gen. And to paraphrase the Bible, the Next Generation begot Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine begot Voyager. Voyager yep. begot Enterprise, and so on and so forth. So I don't think we would have Next Gen if we didn't have the return of the Enterprise crew on the big screen. So I think we owe a lot to the adventures of Captain Kirk and the crew of the Starship Enterprise on the silver screen.
I agree with you 100%. The good thing is the trilogy did so well, because we talk about 2, 3, and 4, which are the three best of the, well, my opinion obviously varies because you like 6, but, and I do too. 2, 3, and 4 did so well that probably, you know, in between episodes, or I should say parts 3 and 4 is when they probably started talking about Next Gen as a series, because the series would debut in 1987. Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think it, Jedi came out in May of 83, and at the time, Turkey Giles himself there, Mr. Lucas, said we'd never see anything again, which of course was a lie. So that franchise was kind of, in mothballs, which gave Trek a chance to kind of own outer space, both on the big and little screens.
Yeah, that's very true.
Post
1983 is what a lot of 1983 to 1997 was what a lot of Star Wars fans referred to as the dark times.
The dark times,
because all you had was novels and the occasional video game.
And the occasional video game, and of course, or you can use the term that Who fans call it, the wilderness between 1989 and 2005, sans 1996. This is a great epic 6 films. With great cast, great acting, great action, some funny moments, a few pitfalls, a few trips, but not enough to sully what is an amazing franchise of actors and moments. So farewell to the TOS crew, except the captain, because on our next episode next week, we'll see him one more time to bridge the gap. Tech, always a pleasure. You can follow Tech on Twitter at Hal Dameron. You know who both those guys are. And follow him on Instagram at, go ahead and spell it.
At Technicolor, TKNIKOLOR.
There you are. You can, of course, follow me on Twitter at PTB Podfather, and follow the brand at Place to Be Nation. Hope you enjoy this. Join us next time when we bridge the gap from one captain to the other as our next crew graduates from the small screen to the big screen. He's Tech. I'm Scott. I'll trust David Warner regardless what facial hair he has. Talk to you next week.